You are listening to Radio Aryan.
Welcome to Aryan Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 7th of October 2019 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAryan.com. Well, I'm very pleased to say that I have my co-host with me today, Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, how are you doing? I believe you're in the middle of a rainstorm and floods and monsoon season over there, am I correct?
No, not at all. It's it's autumnal weather, but nothing out of the ordinary.
Wow. I just saw the weather forecast and it said, oh, there's floods of rain and it's terrible. So that's great. You've got good weather there. I've got good weather here. Can't really say that Boris Johnson has been faring very well over the last week, though, weather-wise or not. Apparently, he has said to a Scottish court that he is going to obey the Benn Act, which is basically this act that's been forced through Parliament, which says that he has to go begging to the EU, begging for an extension. And it's even got a letter attached to the act, a pre-written letter that he has to sign. And don't forget that this act should never even taken place anyway. The only reason that it was able to is because the Speaker of the House bent the laws of precedent and said that the opposition could actually table motions in Parliament, something which has never happened before. But that's the only reason this was able to pass, and they rushed it through Parliament. And now we've got the Scottish courts once again interfering and demanding that Boris Johnson, in writing to them, say that he will promise to obey this law. And straight away afterwards, UK Gov put out a statement saying that we will be leaving, whether we have a deal or not, on October the 31st. And other ministers have said, well, Boris is promising to obey the law, which is something that he has continually said, that he will obey the law. So I'm thinking, well, there are three possibilities here that I can see. There's talk of him paying Hungary to veto any extension, which is one possibility. Second possibility is that he will bring in the Civil Contingencies Act that we talked about last week. And the third possibility is that he could say that EU law supersedes British law, and EU law says that we need to leave on October the 31st because that's part of Article 50 that was enacted. I mean, there may be some other way he could get around this. I mean, another thing that they're saying is he could resign or they could push him out if he refuses to do this. And then they're talking about having John Bercow, the Speaker of the House, as a temporary Prime Minister of a unity government, as they call it, which is not a unity government. It's the losers, basically, of the referendum that will be making up this government. So those are the three possibilities that I see happening, because it is very, very strange that he's promised to do this, and yet, on the other hand, he's saying, well, we're still going to be leaving by October the 31st. So he's obviously got something up his sleeve, hasn't he?
Well, this law, the Surrender Act, just requires him to write the letter and send it. It doesn't say that the letter has to actually arrive at the other at its destination. And so as long as Boris Johnson writes the letter and sends it and can demonstrate that he has in good faith sent the letter, then if it was to be intercepted on the way, then his job would have been done and he couldn't be prosecuted. And if the letter didn't arrive at the other end, then the European Union would have no paperwork to act upon. So it just occurred to me that I don't know, that there are all sorts of devious ways by which a letter could go astray without the knowledge of the, without foreknowledge of the Prime Minister. That's perhaps a possibility. Who knows?
He'd still be obeying the law, wouldn't he? He'd be obeying the letter of the law, if not the spirit of the law. So there are these possibilities. They're also talking about possibly he could be sacked and by the Queen, although I can't really see the Queen doing that, and then him refusing to leave. And I don't really know why they're talking about this. I mean, how they're going to pressure the Queen into sacking the Prime Minister, I don't know. And again, then they're talking about putting Speaker Burko in his place, or even getting Speaker Burko to send the letter and supersede the Prime Minister. I mean, they're really just taking away all the Prime Minister's authority here in this power grab of the people that lost the referendum, basically. And all the while they're doing it, they're screaming about democracy and how they're wanting to save democracy. We've also had last week details of the deal that Boris Johnson is putting forward to the EU. And basically what he's talking about doing is having checkpoints not at the border, but on the outskirts of Northern Ireland, or actually on England, I think on the coasts is where he's talking about. So that then he doesn't upset the Irish. But what you were saying to me, Max, was something about that there's nothing about border checks anyway in the Good Friday Agreement.
Yeah, that's right. It just occurred to me to refer to the original text of the Good Friday Agreement just to see exactly what it does say about border checks. And having read the Good Friday Agreement 3 from cover to cover, or from start to finish, there isn't a single reference to border checks whatsoever. And so when people assert that it is necessary in order to comply with that Good Friday Agreement that there cannot be any border checks, then they're talking utter rubbish. And it would be interesting to hear why these people think that that is the case. You know, they sometimes refer to the spirit of the Good Friday Agreement. Well, if the Good Friday Agreement doesn't actually mention border checks in any way whatsoever, how can having border checks be part of the spirit of it? Now, if it referred to them and said, oh, it would be nice if there were no border checks, then you could say, well, OK, it would be in keeping with the spirit of the Good Friday Agreement if there were no border checks. But if the Good Friday Agreement makes no reference to them whatsoever, then I can't see how anybody can interpret not having border checks as being anything to do with the Good Friday Agreement at all.
I think they're just prevaricating. I mean, we also had Leo Varadkar, the gay Pakistani Prime Minister of Ireland, or the TSAC, I think they call him, and he had the gall to say last week that nobody wanted Brexit, and that the majority of the people in Britain didn't actually want Brexit, and they wanted to stay within the EU. I don't know quite how he squares that with all the opinion polls that say that there are more people that now want us to leave. And also, just on the subject of opinion polls there, the most recent one shows that the Tories are, I think, 15 points ahead of Labour. Boris Johnson is going down very, very well with the general British public. I think it's something like 30%, 31%, 32%, and Labour are there at something like 17%. And the Liberal Democrats have dropped 5 points as well after their conference, where they said that they were going to go back on the referendum. And also it's come out that Jo Swinson, I believe her husband is something to do with the EU. I mean, they're just really treasonous, these Liberal Democrats are. They even had one of the top EU people speaking at their conference. So basically, we're being told in the mainstream media what a terrible person Boris Johnson is, and they're making him out to be a groper and a womanizer and all the sort of things that they were attacking Donald Trump over. And all the while that they're doing that, his ratings just keep increasing, and he keeps getting more and more support from the public, which shows that the public are more in tune with the sort of things that we talk about here on Arian Britannia than what the BBC talk about. I don't know if you've got anything else on that you want to talk about with Brexit, Max?
No. I think we've talked enough about Brexit over the last few weeks, haven't we? So time to give that a rest, I think. Wait to see what happens.
Yeah, it's not too much exciting Brexit news last week, but we have got an interesting subject to talk about today, and that is Captain Cook, who was a really fearless adventurer, a very brave British man who did so many things. He was the first to do so many things, and it's been 250 years since he first circumnavigated New Zealand and initiated contact with the Maoris that were there. And basically, it should be a big celebration of this fact, but as usual, the Maoris, the non-whites, are complaining about this and demanding apologies and refusing to allow replicas of Captain Cook's ship to actually dock there. And they would have nothing if it wasn't for white people going there and building a civilization. And the man himself, Captain James Cook, I mean, he sounds like an absolute hero to me, like an old school British hero. He was born on the 7th of November, 1728, died on the 14th of February, 1779. He was a British explorer, navigator, cartographer, and captain in the Royal Navy. And he actually started off, his father was a farm worker, so he started off as just a labourer and managed to work his way up to being captain in the Royal Navy. And he made detailed maps of Newfoundland prior to making three voyages to the Pacific Ocean, during which he achieved the first recorded European contact with the eastern coastline of Australia and the Hawaiian Islands, and the first recorded circumnavigation of New Zealand. In three voyages, Cook sailed thousands of miles across largely uncharted areas of the globe. He mapped lands from New Zealand to Hawaii in the Pacific Ocean in greater detail and a scale not previously charted by Western explorers. He was also the first to make contact with the inhabitants of both. As he progressed in his voyages of discovery, he surveyed and named features and recorded islands and coastlines on European maps for the first time. He displayed a combination of seamanship, superior surveying and cartographic skills, physical courage, and an ability to lead men in adverse conditions. Following on from his exertions in Newfoundland, Cook wrote that he intended to go not only further than any man has been before me, but as far as I think it is possible for a man to go. A great quote there. Cook was attacked and killed in 1779 during his third exploratory voyage in the Pacific while attempting to recover a sailing vessel stolen from one of his ships. He left a legacy of scientific and geographical knowledge that influenced his successors well into the 20th century, and numerous memorials worldwide have been dedicated to him. And that's the sort of people that we have in our history. Amazing people like that, that just sail off in wooden vessels with sails on a ship, and they get all the way to Antarctica, and they map New Zealand. I mean, he was a bit of an astronomer as well, and he recorded, I believe it was an eclipse of Venus or something like that, while also on a secret mission to find this fabled continent that existed beyond New Zealand. He made all these contact with these savages, and he was a scientist as well. He was a botanist, just an all-round good guy, I think. This is the sort of person in our history that young people at school should be taught about. This is what they should be studying, not Black History Month. I mean, had you heard of, well, obviously you must have heard of Captain Cook before, but had you looked into him before this episode at all, Max?
Not for some years, but I mean, obviously earlier on during my youth and during my education, I would have learned about Captain Cook. And you're absolutely right that he is the sort of person who would, in times gone by, have been held up as a heroic character and somebody to be emulated. His whole life, in fact, was filled with the sort of stuff of boys' own comics of the sort of 50s and 60s. And it's just it's just so disappointing that there is this continual whinging and whining on the part of lefties and on the part of the representatives of the ethnic minorities in the various countries that he explored, decrying the man and decrying the things that he did. Quite often, with regard to North America, there are assertions made by the representatives of the North American Indians. There are assertions made by representatives of the Australian Aborigines and now the Maoris that they were sort of genocided and all this sort of thing, and that they demand to have apologies from the European nations that first explored and first colonized their countries. And yet, when you actually investigate into the prehistory of those countries, when you investigate into the period prior to European explorers going to those countries, what you find is that there wasn't this sort of uniform population of people spread across the lands who were all living in harmony with nature, who were all like these noble savages who never did any harm and who, from an ecological perspective, were marvelous, you know, living in balance with nature and all this sort of thing. That wasn't the case at all. You know, what we find when we look into the situation prior to European explorers going there is that these peoples were broken down into various tribal groups, and these tribal groups warred with each other. They used to try and steal each other's land. They used to try and steal each other's livestock. They would wage war against each other. And when they won their wars, very often they were genocidal in the way that they dealt with the defeated tribe. The only sort of complaint they can have is that when Europeans went to their countries, we were just so much better at fighting than they were. And that we prevailed eventually in subduing them. And that's the only difference. You know, they were fighting with stone tools and with spears and arrows and things of that sort, whereas we arrived and we were technologically superior and had firearms and with very small numbers of men, we actually quelled them and managed to colonize their countries. That was the only difference. Now, I'm not a great believer in colonialism. I think that colonialism has some good points and some bad points. But on the other hand, but the point I'd like to make now is that there is nothing that Europeans have done which is any worse than was already being done by the various warring tribes in North America, in Australia, and amongst the Maoris. And in fact, after there was initial contact between European traders and the Maoris, and this is going back to like the early 1800s, where the Maoris were sold potatoes, which enabled them to grow more food than they'd ever had before. And when they were sold, muskets, they then followed between 1801 and 1840, what were called the Musket Wars, during which something like 60% of the Maori population was massacred. This wasn't the doing of white people. This isn't white people fighting with Maoris. This is Maoris fighting Maoris. And something like 30 to 40,000 Maoris were actually killed during that period, out of approximately 60,000 Maoris that existed before white people went to New Zealand. So that's like an astounding statistic when you realise that, and often also the victorious tribes involved performed cannibalism on their defeated adversaries, and so again the only difference between what the European peoples did, even if we were as bad as they've painted us, the only difference being that we were so much better at warfare than they were.
That's something to be proud of. You know, there's something to be proud of. We were superior. We were superior in fighting them, and we were honourable when we won. I mean, we gave the Indians reservations. When we defeated these people, we didn't tie them up and then allow the women to torture them, which is what the Maoris did, before then chopping their body parts up into different pieces. We didn't turn their arms into hooks that we could attach to the walls so that we could hang baskets on them. We didn't chop their body up into little bits and use their bones for necklaces and drink their brains and eat their eyeballs and all these other elements of savagery that these Maoris had. And yes, I mean, colonialism really hasn't done us any favours. But it's done a hell of a lot of favors for these people, because it's civilized their countries. It's brought them infrastructure. And the whole point of colonialism, it was necessary. I mean, if you look at how many people you had in Britain and that you had in Europe, everybody, you know, you've got a man and a woman and they're going to produce 10 children. Where were those 10 children going to go? the eldest son is going to be given the, was traditionally given the land and the family farm, and that would always go to the eldest son. But then all the rest of them would have to go out and find their own bit of land somewhere for, and raise their own family. So, of course, you're going to want to get away from Britain, which has already been civilized and settled for 2,000 years, 3,000 years. And you're going to want to go and find somewhere new that is unsettled. So they would go off in these ships and try to discover a new land. If there were other peoples that were already there, they would try to buy the land from them. They would try to do an exchange with them. And it becomes quite clear from Captain Cook's notes that he wasn't just seeking to genocide these people or execute these people. They wanted to trade with them. They wanted to buy a little bit of land so that they could settle there. And it was the same in Australia. It was the same in America. And then what you had in America was they ended up with Red Indians that started stealing the cattle. They would do a deal. They would sell their land. They would come to a treaty that they wouldn't go on the white man's land. And they would go in there and they would steal the cattle and they'd make war against them. And then you had Red Indians that would come to the white man and say, can you please protect us from these savages that want to rip our hearts out and sacrifice us to the sun god, please? And the white man would go and fight against the savages because they were being so mean to the other savages. Basically, the white man has always tried to be honorable in the way that he fought. And before we went on air, Max, weren't you telling me about how the prior people that actually lived on New Zealand, these Maoris, they didn't actually arrive there until about 1,000 years ago? And didn't they wipe out the people that were previously there? Is that correct?
Yeah, there are references to the population that existed prior to the Maori colonization of New Zealand, because, you know, a lot of people think that the Maoris have lived in New Zealand since time immemorial, but in reality, the Maoris were part of the Polynesian expansion across the Pacific, and they didn't actually go to New Zealand until around about the 1300s. And prior to that, there were only very small populations of hunter-gatherers who had existed there and were presumably of kind of Australian Aboriginal kind of racial stock. And these people were the hunters of the large flightless birds that existed on New Zealand at the time, the moa, and the Adzabil, and the Maoris then colonized the islands, and these people just disappeared. And so, you know, one has to assume that these people were driven into extinction by the Maoris. The Maoris apparently didn't occupy uniformly the whole of New Zealand. When European explorers first went to New Zealand, there were large tracts of New Zealand that were uninhabited. So it's not as if all of New Zealand was actually taken from the Maoris. And as far as the Maoris were concerned, they exterminated the flightless birds that had previously existed there, as did the other Polynesians that settled in places like Easter Island, where they stripped the island bare of all of its trees. So if you go to Easter Island, which is in the eastern, southeastern Pacific, which is quite close to South America, and you go to Easter Island, one of the notable things about Easter Island is that there are these large sculptures that were presumably have been made by the Polynesians that settled there. But the Polynesian settlers also just basically cut down all the trees, so there wasn't a single tree standing when the first European explorers went to Easter Island. And the same thing happened in New Zealand, in that the Maoris landing in New Zealand caused deforestation of large parts of New Zealand. And again, you see that this contradicts the idea that's always put forward, that prior to Europeans going to these countries, that the people were there living in harmony with nature, when in fact they weren't. They actually had quite an adverse impact on large parts of the ecosystem once they landed there. And this again is true of the Australian Aborigines that When they first colonized Australia, there was what was called megafauna that lived in Australia up until around about 46,000 years ago. And it's now estimated that the very first anatomically modern humans arrived in Australia around about 60,000 years ago. And in the two millennia following that arrival, large numbers of most of the large prey animals in Australia were driven into extinction, and they included the Diprotodon, which was a hippo-sized wombat, the marsupial tapir, which was around about the size of a horse, the marsupial lion, which was a flesh-eating marsupial animal that was quite a considerable size. And also the Prosoptodon, which is a kind of giant kangaroo. And so these animals were exterminated by the Australian Aborigines. Also, the Australian Aborigines introduced the dingo to Australia. And so that, again, the introduction of these wild dogs did, domesticated dogs, as they probably would have been originally, caused a massive impact on the ecosystem in Australia as well. So again, this just goes to show that the kind of denigration that is directed at Europeans because we colonize these countries is totally misplaced, because having colonized these countries, we are the only people who have actually instigated ecological management systems aimed at preserving the species that we can, despite the fact that, you know, there are some species that have actually become extinct since we've been there and were made extinct beforehand. We're the very first people to implement these kind of ecology management systems with the intention of preserving species and also of reintroducing the now extinct species back into the wild. We're the only people that have done this, and we don't get any credit for it, which is a great shame.
Oh, it's the law of nature, isn't it, that the superior creature will subjugate the weaker creature. And it is quite right too, because the white man is superior, and if it's the white man that is running things, then you get conservation programs, you get the environment looked after. They put the Red Indians on reservations. They don't turn them all into slaves or exterminate them all, like the Maori did with the Polynesians or the Aborigines that were there before them. I mean, I would suggest that they probably ate them, and that's why there's no remains of these people that were there. So they're basically savages, and Captain Cook went there and introduced civilization to the island, and what should be a great celebration for the New Zealanders of this, you know, it's been 250 years since this great British hero basically started this settlement there. And rather than celebrating, Britain is being forced to apologise for doing this. And this article, that, I mean, there's quite a few of them. It was on the BBC News over the weekend, and this article actually comes from The Ecologist. It says, Boris Johnson's government has refused to apologise to Maori tribal leaders today for the massacre that took place in New Zealand in 1769. Laura Clark, the British High Commissioner to New Zealand, who I have to say did absolutely look extremely elegant and beautiful and like a very good example of an English lady. I just have to put in there, but sadly, she appears to be somewhat of an SJW. She is meeting tribal leaders in the town of Gisborne in the country's North Island as they mark the anniversary of Captain James Cook and the crew of his ship Endeavour arriving 250 years ago. She will express regret that British explorers killed many of the first indigenous Maori they came across in New Zealand in 1769. But according to the Press Association, she will not be issuing a full apology. A High Commission spokesman said, the expression of regret responds to a request from the local Iwi tribe for this history to be heard and acknowledged. The British High Commissioner will acknowledge the pain of those first encounters, acknowledge that the pain does not diminish over time, and extend her sympathy to the descendants of those killed, he said. It is not how any of us would have wanted those first encounters to have transpired. Soon after arriving, fearing they were under attack, the sailors shot and killed a leader, Timaro, and later killed 8 more Maori. The High Commission statement said both Captain Cook and botanist Joseph Banks had written in their diaries that they regretted the deaths. It added that the exact wording of Miss Clark's speech to the Maori leaders would remain private. And just looking at that, you think, is that all it was? 9 people? They killed 9 people 250 years ago, and they're demanding an apology, and this High Commissioner is humouring them and saying, oh, the pain doesn't diminish over time, and have my sympathy to the descendants. I don't even know who my ancestors were 250 years ago. I'm sure some of them probably got shot and killed in wars that went on, and I'm not claiming that I'm somehow in pain and needing sympathy today because they were killed, and it's just 9 people. That was all, 9 people, and they're calling it a massacre and making a huge thing about this. And, you know, Captain Cook and his crew, they thought they were under attack. I mean, these guys were waving spears at them, and they shot first and asked questions later. Quite rightfully so. If they hadn't have done that, it may have been Captain Cook and his crew that were attacked. I mean, that's what should be said to these people that are demanding apologies. They should have said, well, look, if your ancestors hadn't been waving spears and didn't have a reputation for slaughtering people and eating their brains and drinking their blood, then perhaps they wouldn't have got shot. Of course, we're not going to apologise for it. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous that the way that the British High Commission has behaved here, I think. Max, what are your comments on this?
Well, I've done a bit of research. I went to the New Zealand Electronic Text Collection, which has been compiled by the Victoria University of Wellington, and this, they've got some very interesting notes there. One of which, just to start off with, kind of sets the scene as far as the kind of man that Captain Cook was, because it mentions in this the what they refer to as the milch goat. And it says here, the most famous amongst their livestock on board, this is on board the boat, the Endeavour, was a much travelled milch goat. According to an informant of the General Evening Post, London, on 17th of July, 1771, she had been in the West Indies for 3 years before she was taken round the world on the Dolphin, which was between 1766 and 1768. When the Endeavour returned to London in 1771, her travels, this is this milch goat, therefore had included 2 round-the-world voyages. The correspondent added, she never went dry during the whole voyage, and we mean to reward her services by placing her in a good English pasture for the rest of her life. And Dr. Samuel Johnson, who's quite famous, was greatly interested in the story of the goat's travels, and on the 27th of February 1772, he wrote, in fame, scarce second to the nurse of love, the nurse of Jove, this goat, which twice the world travelled round, deserving both her master's care and love, ease and perpetual pasture now has found. And so, because this goat had provided them with milk on their two circumnavigations of the globe, the crew of Captain Cook's ship decided to provide for the goat and make sure that it had a pasture so that it could live out the rest of its life in a sort of happy rest, basically. And so that kind of, so, you know, the men of Captain Cook's ship and Captain Cook and his other officers, they weren't hard men. They weren't uncaring men. They were men who showed a great amount of kindness and sensitivity. But if we look at the further in with regard to the notes here, there are several accounts actually of the very first encounter with the Maoris. And so Cook wrote regarding the first landing, we landed abreast of the ship and on the east side of the river, but seeing some of the natives on the other side of the river, whom I was desirous of speaking with, and finding that we could not ford the river, I ordered the yawl, which is a boat, in to carry us over the and the pinnace, which is another kind of boat, to lay at the entrance. In the meantime, the Indians made off. However, we went as far as their huts, which lay about 200 or 300 yards from the waterside, the northern side of the Wakanee Creek, leaving four boys to care for the yawl, which we had no sooner left than four men came out of the woods on the other side of the river and would certainly have cut her off had not the people in the pinnace discovered them and called her to drop down the stream, which they did, being closely pursued by the Indians. So they'd landed. The main body of the crew had started to wander off down towards the natives' huts, and then some of the natives had come out of the forest and were then pursuing the boys that had been left to guard the boats as they tried to retreat so that the boats wouldn't be captured by them. It was at this juncture that the first of several unfortunate slayings took place. The coxswain of the pinnace, in an attempt to intimidate the natives, i.e. to deter them from rushing at them, fired a musket twice over their heads. The first shot caused the natives to stop and look around, but they took no notice of the second. A third shot was then fired, and it killed one of the natives just as he was about to throw his spear at the boat. The name of the man killed was Timaro. The other three stood motionless for a minute or two, wondering that was that had killed their comrade. As soon as they recovered their senses, they dragged the body about 100 yards away. So Cook and his party immediately returned to the yawl before leaving for the ship. In viewing the body, they said that the native was shot through the heart. He was a middling-sized man, tattooed on one cheek only in spirals. Lines are very regularly formed. He was covered in a fine cloth of a manufacture totally new to us. His hair was also tied in a knot on the top of his head. His complexion was brown, but not very dark. So the boats then returned to the ship at about 6 o'clock. So that was the very first shooting in which one man was killed, who presumably was the chieftain that's been referred to. And then on the second day, Tuesday, the 10th of October, there was one of the crew members called Parkinson, and his account was, in the early morning of the 10th, the longboat, pinnace and yawl went on shore again, and the party landed near the river where they had been on the night before and attempted to find a watering place. Because basically what Cook had landed there for wasn't to colonize the land or anything of that sort. He was looking for fresh water. And so and what they found was that there was a stream entering the sea there, but the stream was full of brackish water. Several of the natives came towards them, and with much entreating, we prevailed upon some of them to cross the river, to whom we gave several things, which they carried back to their companions. So when these natives came closer to them, they actually gave them gifts in order as like peace offerings, which the natives then carried back to their companions on the other side of the river, who seemed to be highly pleased with them and testified their joy by a war dance. Appearing to be so peaceably disposed, our company went over to them and were received in a friendly manner. We would have purchased some of their weapons, but could not prevail upon them to part with them on any terms. One of them, however, watched an opportunity and snatched a hanger from us. Our people resented the affront by firing upon them and killed three of them on the spot. So a hanger, it's not a term that's in general use, but a hanger is an infantry sword. And so what had happened there was that they offered gifts to the Maori tribes people that they encountered, but not satisfied with the gifts, the Maori wanted to obtain the weapons that the crew of the Endeavour had, and so one of them, as I've just read out, snatched this sword and made off with it, and was then shot. Banks, who was another of the crew members, said, as soon as we appeared at the riverside, the Indians came up, and every man produced a long pike or small weapon of well-polished stone, about a foot long and thick enough to weigh 4 or 5 pounds. With these, they threatened us and signed us to depart. And then Lieutenant Gore, in his unpublished journal, says that the Indians formed up in two lines, brandishing their spears, and gave a war dance, rolling their eyes and obtruding their tongues as they swayed, first to one side and then the other. And then Banks adds, a musket was then fired wide of them, the ball of which struck the water. They saw the effect and immediately ceased their threats. The landing party comprised of Cook, Banks, a botanist called Solander, an astrologer called Green and the native interpreter who's called Tupai. So Tupai told the natives that they were willing to exchange iron for provisions, but the natives didn't really understand what iron was and didn't really see the value of it. But this native translator warned Cook's crew that the Maori natives couldn't be trusted, that they were suspicious and were treacherous. And so obviously Cook had taken notice of them. Let's see what's the rest of the.
Well, there must have been a few more killed, but I think that gives us the idea that this wasn't a massacre at all. This was this was quite rightfully, they're trying to steal swords, they're trying to steal boats, and it's the equivalent of somebody trying to steal the policeman's weapon, and then they're shot, and all they did was just shoot the one man that tried to steal the sword. They didn't massacre all of them, and they had good reason to be worried that this was the sort of thing that was going to happen to them. As well, I mean, New Zealand was apparently, it was first discovered in 1642 by the Dutchman Abel Tasman, who sighted the new land on his voyage in the Pacific. He travelled up the west coast for over a month, attempting unsuccessfully in the face of hostility from the native inhabitants to land and obtain fresh water. So that was the experience that they've had before, is they just want to land and get fresh water, and these Maori attack them. And they're hostile towards them. So this wasn't a peaceful people. And that was the attack that they're saying was a massacre, Max.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, that chief that you mentioned there. That's the one that they're most worried about.
But there was another incident, though, where one of the Maori boats came out to Cook's ship, and they invited these people on board and gave them again lots of gifts, which were peace offerings, and gave them food. And then at the end of the day, most of the Maoris got back into their canoes and sailed off back to the shore. But these three of them stayed behind, and the Cook's men were then going to return the three to the shore. But then they said no, they didn't want to be returned to the shore at this particular place, which is where the others had dropped off, because they claimed that the others were a different tribe, and if they were put ashore there, then these people would kill them. And so they managed to prevail upon Cook to keep them on their ship, and the ship's crew fed them and gave them clothing, and then put them ashore somewhere further down the coast the following day. And so what this shows basically is that there was no hostile attitude on the part of Cook's men. Cook's men were, landed on New Zealand soil, and were then presented or confronted by people who were aggressive, who were performing war dances, who were waving spears, and who were carrying heavy clubs. And who then attempted to steal their weapons. And there's like other accounts that you can read on from that same source, where the various individuals mention how the Maoris were trying to snatch their muskets and run off with their muskets. And so the people that were killed were all killed because they were doing something which was openly aggressive, basically, or attempting to steal the weapons of the crew of the Endeavour.
And the British commissioner should be pointing that out, not bending over backwards and going along with this nonsense story. They should be going from the reports of Captain Cook and his men, which show them to be compassionate people. But it gets worse than that, because, as I said, there's a replica of the Endeavour that's been created, a life-size replica of Captain Cook's ship, and that's doing a circumnavigation of New Zealand, only it's been banned from docking in two places now. A village in New Zealand has banned a replica of Captain Cook's ship from docking there to mark 250 years since the explorer's arrival, after an outcry from the local Maori community. Anaheta Herbert Graves, the head of Northland's Ngati Kahu Iwi, or tribe, told RNZ he, Cook, was a barbarian. Wherever he went, like most people of the time of imperial expansion, There were murders, there were abductions, there were rapes, and just a load of bad outcomes for the indigenous people. He didn't discover anything down here, and we object to Tuya 250 using euphemisms like encounters and meetings to disguise what were actually invasions. Last year, indigenous campaigner Tina Nagata criticised the upcoming events. Cook was a murderer. He was an invader, and he was a vanguard for British imperial expansion. If you read through his own journals and the journals of the crew members, it was not uncommon for him to shoot at us, to steal from us, for abductions to happen, and in fact, whole communities were wiped out through sexually transmitted diseases. You know, are they reading the same journals here that you were reading from there, Max?
I don't think so. I think that these people have just interpreted things. You see, one thing we have to bear in mind is that prior to Europeans going to New Zealand, there were there was no writing. The Maoris didn't have a form of writing, and so that they have got no history. So they don't know what actually took place prior to white people going there, because it was only when once white people went there that their history was actually written down. There is a great lack of appreciation of history. And if you think about it, you know, the descriptions of the encounter that happened could be transposed into a slightly different situation. We could imagine what would happen if a large spaceship suddenly docked just above the Earth, and the spaceship then had a small shuttle vessel that shuttled a number of beings down to Earth. And as these beings landed on Earth, that the country in which they landed suddenly had amassed all of its military might around them with their weapons pointing at them. How do you think that the people in the spaceship would react to that? Would they assume that they were being given a friendly welcome? Or would they assume that the inhabitants of Earth were actually hostile to them, and that the lives of their people that had travelled down to the Earth's surface were in grave danger, and would take the appropriate action to defend their people? I think, you know, that's exactly the way it would be interpreted. So as far as Captain Cook's explorations are concerned, in the vast majority of cases, he would have been exploring uncharted territory. He would have been the very first white, well, his crew would have been the very first white people that the natives would have encountered. And the source that I've gone to for the notes that I've read out earlier on also states that descendants of some of the Maoris that were involved in that particular tribe have stated that the folk wisdom that's passed down through the generations since was that, or the folk impression was that when they first saw the Endeavour, they thought that it was a giant bird upon the water, and they thought the sails were its wings, and when Captain Cook's crew came out in their boats, they thought that they were being visited by the gods. And so it is exactly a parallel to a situation where, you know, we would have a large spacecraft suddenly docking off the in Earth orbit, and them sending down a small boat with a crew to explore the surface of the Earth. And, you know, if you encounter that sort of thing happening, it's only natural that you would be fearful for what the consequences might be. And so as far as the Earth is concerned, if an alien race of people landed from outer space, then it would be only natural for us to be fearful as to what their intentions would be. And in the same way, it's only natural that the Maori tribespeople would have been fearful of the intention of Cook's crew, etc. This whole thing really just illustrates how in these kind of situations, it's very, very easy for a for hostilities to break out. And if you start to take liberties with the people that have landed, like trying to steal their equipment, etc., then that is the kind of action that is likely to trigger off some hostilities. And so
totally reasonable. It's totally reasonable. So, it's expected behaviour on both sides, I think. I think it's totally reasonable behaviour from Cook to start shooting them. And, you know, you would expect them to either be hostile or be friendly. If they're going to be hostile, then they should expect to fight. You know, they shouldn't expect to be whining 250 years later. And, I mean, calling Captain Cook a barbarian, I mean, that's just unbelievable. They're calling him a barbarian. The Maori have got an IQ of 90. Non-Maori natives got an IQ of 85. You can probably guess that Captain Cook's was probably about 110, 120. And these people that are saying this, they're cannibals and headhunters. They preserved the heads of their enemies in a form known as mokamokai. They removed the brain and eyes and smoked the head. And the heads were then sold to European collectors in the late 1800s, in some instances having been commissioned and made to order. And they continued doing this right up into the 20th century, in fact. I've got a load of quotes here about some of the things that they got up to. And bear in mind, these are the people that are now calling Captain Cook a barbarian. This is a first quote. It's from a book called The Whalers by Dr. Felix Maynard and Alexander Dumas, 1937. There is not a bay, not a cove in New Zealand which has not witnessed horrible dramas, and woe to the white man who falls into the New Zealander's hands. And it's 1937. So what's that? 80 years ago? Elsdon Best said the dreadful Maori custom, or at least occasional habit, of exhuming and eating buried human bodies was also a Fijian custom. So it wasn't just fresh ones either. They would dig up bodies out of the ground and eat them. I got one here from Captain Cook, and then I'll pass it over to you for a comment, Max. He says, one of the cannibals thereupon bit and gnawed the human arm which Banks had picked up, drawing it through his mouth and showing by signs that the flesh to him was a dainty bit. Tupia carried on the conversation. Where are the heads? He asked. Do you eat them too? Of the heads, answered an old man, we eat only the brains. Later he brought on board the Endeavour four of the heads of the seven victims. The hair and flesh were entire, but we perceived that the brains had been extracted. The flesh was soft, but had by some method been preserved from putrefaction, for it had no disagreeable smell. This custom of eating their enemies slain in battle, for I firmly believe they eat the flesh of no others, has undoubtedly been handed down to them from earliest times, and we know it is not an easy matter to wean a nation from their ancient customs, let them be ever so inhuman and savage, especially if that nation has no manner of connection or commerce with strangers. For it is by this that the greatest part of the human race has been civilized, an advantage which the New Zealanders, from their situation, never had. One of the arguments they made use of to Tapia, who frequently expostulated with them against this custom, was that there could be no harm in killing and eating the man who would do the same by them if it was in his power. For, said they, can there be any harm in eating our enemies, whom we have killed in battle? Would not those very enemies have done the same to us? I have often seen them listen to Tapia with great attention, but I never found his arguments have any weight with them. When Odidi and several of our people showed their abhorrence of it, they only laughed at them. So he's saying there that, you know, it's going to be very hard to actually get them to stop carrying out this custom. And as I say, there's instances of it going on right on into the 20th century.
There's been lots of instances reported of cannibalism of that sort, where it involves eating either the brain or the heart of a defeated enemy, and the belief is that if you eat your enemy's brain, then you or heart, then you inherit the enemy's ferocity and strength, and so it's a way of sort of enhancing yourself by doing this. This is the sort of the rationale behind the whole thing. I've actually seen some shrunken heads in museums. They don't seem to display them any longer because it's regarded as being insulting to the person whose head it was effectively. So lots of shrunken heads that were produced in times gone by and which used to be displayed in museums in this country have now been sent back to the indigenous people, and in all probability sent back to the people whose ancestors actually killed and ate the person whose shrunken head it was, so that the shrunken head can be buried. Under the pretext that by doing that they are in some way honouring the dead person, but one can't help thinking that it is to hide evidence of such recent practices as cannibalism, rather than to honour the person.
Yeah, and in Papua New Guinea, they are quite open that they still have the headhunters. They still have the headhunters there. I mean, particularly sickness. I mean, they really made use of every single part of the human body. As I was saying with the arms, they would cut the arms off, smoke them in front of the fire, and bend the hands so that it was like in a U shape, and then they would like sort of nail the arm to the wall, and they would use the hand as a hook. So you could just sort of hang your clothes on it. And they would use the bones for all sorts of things. As I say, I've got another quote here. This is from A.P. Rice in the American Antiquarian, 1910. A young Maori convert of a particularly gentle and lovable disposition, very shy, even timid, and extremely popular with everyone at the mission where he was employed. That gives us a description of him. One day he happened to meet a young girl who had run away for some reason from her home in a neighbouring village. The young Maori suddenly became possessed of an unaccustomed demon. He seized the young girl, took her to his hut, killed her in cold blood, cut up her body in the traditional manner, and then invited his friends to partake with him in a meal, the chief and most favoured dish of which consisted of this young Maori girl. So that was 1910, and that was a Christian convert that they thought was a gentle and lovable person. I mean, this is the same sort of thing that we see today with blacks, that they say, oh, they're perfectly civilized, they're just like everybody else, and then something can just tip them off, and they get into a fury, and they will carry out the most heinous crimes against the person that they're fighting with. I can recall one instance in Africa where one of them pulled out somebody's heart and then began eating it. And this was in the city as well. This wasn't out in the wilds. And another quote here, again, is from the Whalers, 1937. Tu'e, a New Zealand chief who was brought to London in 1818 and resided there for a long time, becoming almost civilised, confessed in his moments of nostalgia that what he most regretted in the country from which he was absent was the feast of human flesh, the feast of victory. He was wary of eating English beef. He claimed that there was a great analogy between the flesh of the pig and that of the man. This last declaration he made before a sumptuously served table. The flesh of women and children was to him and his fellow countrymen the most delicious, while certain Maoris prefer that of a man of 50, and that of a black rather than that of a white. His countrymen, Tu'e said, never ate the flesh raw, and preserved the fat of the rump for the purpose of dressing their sweet potatoes. So if you're ever in New Zealand, don't get any sweet potatoes from the restaurants there. But I think this destroys this notion that they just cooked up their enemies, because he says here it's the flesh of women and children that he found the most delicious. I mean, they're absolute savages, aren't they?
Yeah, it's most peculiar, yes.
And these are the people saying, you know, Captain Cook was a bad guy, he was a barbarian, he killed these people when he shouldn't have done. And yet the evidence shows you that these were really nasty people, and we did them a favour by bringing law and order to the island and stopping them from killing one another. And yet the British High Commissioner is going along with their nonsense. And nobody that I can see in the press is pointing out the truth of this. You know, Captain Cook was a good man. He was a compassionate man. And he did them a huge favour, and they've turned around and stabbed him in the back. And I've no doubt they're demanding compensation payments as well. Mm-hmm. Do you want to add to that, Max?
No. I think we've just about said all we can really on that, haven't we?
Yeah, I mean, he's just a great man. I'd like to, in fact, I probably will read some of his memoirs, some of his journal, because it does look as if it's written in readable English. It's not all in Old English or anything like that. And the quotes that I got on the cannibalism, they were from the heretical.com site. So with the article that accompanies this, I'll put both them. And also, if you send me a link to that university site that you found, Max, okay. And then our listeners can check them out too. Well, thank you very much for coming on today. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Aryan Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.
An alternative to the anti-white system on RadioArian.com.